And now I can introduce you to Bob. And Bob is the founder of the Institute for Generative Leadership, and he has been in the generative leadership discourse for over 30 years. He's been a practitioner in the trenches with people to really see and experience the power of these distinctions. And that's why he wants to share it with the world, with you today. And he also co-authored the book, The Innovator's Way, and that is available on Amazon. And as I said, he's our course leader in our GLP, Generative Leadership course, as well as the Coaching Excellence in Organizations. If you have more questions at the end of this call, I will stay for a couple of minutes, and I'll also give you my email address, and you know, through the website you'll find how to get a hold of us. And so when you're ready, Bob, we're ready for you.
Great, Johanna. Thank you very much, and welcome to everybody on the call. These calls have a purpose. One is to serve you. One is to give you actual value, actual actions that you can take out into the world. That's our mission, is to make a very powerful discourse of generative action available to leaders and to people who want to produce impact in the world. So we also do these calls so you and the world can get to know our body of work and to get to know the promises that we make to you as an organization in our support of this mission. So I'm Bob Dunham. I have a mission to help people that are in leadership roles or people looking to develop their leadership impact to produce results that they care about, to do this in a way that's healthy and meaningful. And what it's about in the end is to help all of us create a better world. So that's what this is all about. Our topic today, why great performers fail as managers, is a revealing place to look, because when we look at our leadership, and management is one way that we express that in the world, and for us, management is not a title. Management is a function. Management is the coordination of action with other people to produce a result. And from that point of view, this perspective of management is much wider than simply having a title or a role in an organization, but it is certainly fundamental to that as well. So if we look at the journey of going from a point in our career where we get very, very good at what we do, but we haven't yet really had the opportunity to lead a team, to manage others. And what often happens is when you get very good at what you do, when you become a functional expert, and there's an opening or a need for this team leader or this manager, often it's the most competent functional expert who's given that opportunity. And that creates a challenging transition, the transition from being a great performer to being an effective manager. And so to do that is part of what we call the leadership journey. And we're going to explore this question not simply focused only on how do performers fail becoming managers. We're also going to address how they succeed at becoming managers. But I want to put this in a wider context of the journey of developing ourselves as leaders. And when I use the word leader, again, I'm not talking about an organizational role. I'm talking about a human capability to declare a future that other people commit to organize the coordination of action, to take action to produce results that matter. And this, in fact, is the way that human beings create their worlds, create their futures. And so we're going to be looking from this deep, fundamental perspective of how human beings do that and then bring that back into the world of our careers and perhaps our career path in an organizational setting. So that's kind of the context of our conversation today, and we're going to be exploring this learning and development path. This step that we're looking at, the transition from performer to manager, is an unavoidable step in the path of leadership. Manager can go on and have a future step to being an executive. Executive can become a leader beyond the executive function in the world. And these transitions really lose their power and sometimes lead to future breakdowns when this first step of the transition from performer to manager is not made well. So as we look at this fundamental shift, we're looking for what is the great performer need to be aware of and pay attention to when they face this opportunity or challenge of becoming a team leader or a manager. How do we see this new world that opens up with eyes that are paying attention to the right things? How do we understand the new actions that will come up? How do we embody them in a way that's effective? And to do that, the performer needs to be in a mood of exploration and learning. And you understand what I mean by that, because if you're on this call, you're already in the mood of exploration and learning. That's what the invitation is for this conversation we're having here. So what are these challenges? These challenges of going from perform. I remember in my own career when I was a computer programmer, and I happened to get frustrated by what I saw going on around me. I saw poor management. I saw teams in disarray. I saw bad moods. I saw people quitting. And I looked around and said, my fundamental motivation was, why can't we work together in an effective way? Why can't we have our energies going into our success rather than internal friction that seemed to be grinding us up? And that was a question I took seriously. I didn't want to continue to have work and organizational life be a place of suffering, but a place of creating a future that actually was valuable. And so I wound up being given a role. Some of you have heard this story, where I was given a role in Motorola Computer Systems because I began to speak up about what it was I wanted to see happen. I was even going to leave the organization, and I was invited to stay. They gave me the position of a program manager. And program manager was and is a role of a variety of matrix management. What that means is nobody reports to you, but you're supposed to coordinate them in terms of developing plans and fulfilling them. It's cross-organizational. And as a place to develop leadership and management skill, it was a fantastic opportunity, as difficult as it was, because I had to learn the skills of conversations that worked. I had to learn the human dimension that produced action rather than simply having a title that could give orders. And so when I started that job, I had no idea how to do it. I sometimes refer to a poster there. I haven't seen it recently, but perhaps you've seen it, where there's this kitten hanging on a string with their claws out, and that's kind of how I felt when I took this job on. I really didn't know what to do. I was going from performer to manager and was really lost in the whole domain. And I began to look around for help. I asked the managers in the company, where do I go to learn this stuff? And interviewed about a dozen people. I didn't have anyone say, here's what you need to learn, here's how you do it. It pretty much was a revelation that management is kind of a sink or swim profession. You get an opportunity and you learn through hard knocks, and it seems a very inefficient way to do that. But I wound up running into a body of work that asked the following question: what is action? And they answered it not with theory, but with a framework that we're going to utilize in our conversation here, that action actually comes from human beings interacting in conversation, in coordination, and making shared commitments. And the power of those commitments come from the care that people have for them and the competence that they have in order to fulfill the actions they agree to. But the revelation was that it was all about conversations. And so we're going to be using that perspective to begin to see what this territory is that the performer is entering when they become a manager or team leader. It's in conversations. It's the coordination of action between people. And our profession, our mission, becomes people as the source of action. And when we try to impose tasks and process to eliminate the people, we actually wind up losing the power that people bring from their own inspiration. So with that, I wound up finding a solution and really helping my organization shift in a six-month period from not getting anything out the door to getting all the products of the company out the door on time, on budget, at much higher level of quality than had ever been achieved before. And that's why I'm on this call with you. When I saw that, I said, oh my goodness, there's something here that works, that's of value, and I want to share that in the world. And so we're going to bring that framework to this question. But given that example I gave for myself, in my career, I also, as I became a manager, I had 5 promotions in 2.5 years when I finally began to see action in this new way. And I was in an organization that was promoting technical experts into management roles because they didn't have a career path. They had no path for advancement. The only career path was the management. And so I also saw the breakdown of people being promoted into manager roles who weren't competent at it, weren't committed to it, and the disasters that came afterwards. And so eventually in that organization, we developed a technical career path where we could reward the development and progress of technical expertise without having to make them managers. And that's part of my early exposure to this challenge of the performer to manager transition. So I'm going to share with you some perspective. I wrote a blog article some of you may have read. I invite you to, if you haven't, that has some specifics about this transition I think you'll find useful. But in this call, I'm going to go a level deeper, and I'm going to identify 4 major challenges, 4 major barriers that show up in this moment of the path from performer to manager. And before we do that, I'd like to go from the examples that I've experienced to have some of you share examples of situations where the performer to manager has been a challenge, a failure, or a success. So let's get 2 or 3 of you to share your question, your experience, your situation, past, present, or future, and really try to bring our thinking to those real-world situations. So to go ahead and share, just hit *6, and let's just have a chat with a couple of folks about what does this question of performer to manager provoke for you.
Hi, Joan. Delegation.
Yeah, go ahead. How does that show up for you as a challenger?
How does it show up? It's not for me, but for clients, it shows up in an inability to let go of what you've done before and hand it to others to do. It shows a difficulty recognizing that the more you move up in management, the less deep dives you can do, the broader you have to be, the less specific you have become.
Yep.
And I guess it's one other thing, which is a lot of times you have to learn to, if you were someone who was on a team, you have to learn that you're not buddies anymore.
Huh. Yeah, all kinds of challenges show up here. Thank you. What you're saying really resonates for me. It often shows up as an issue of delegation. So let's explore together a little bit. So when the person doesn't delegate, doesn't trust other people, they're hanging on to their role as expert. They're hanging on to the job will get done
right. They're hanging on to what they know.
Exactly. But they're also avoiding the very skills that management are about. They're not going into how do I help other people become great performers? How do I help other people become experts on a path? And delegation is one way that we do that. And when, as a manager in a management role, we're hanging on by not delegating, we're hanging on to our performer role, because in most cases I've found people don't understand what to do as a manager because they have had a career path where they have made success for themselves by being a great performer. And so they hang on to that strategy, and they're afraid of not only delegating because they don't know what to do. And so we're going to talk a little bit about how do we help people in that situation. And you mentioned this not being pals anymore, that there's a different relationship that arises when you go from performer to manager that is really based on who's agreeing to do what for whom. And there's a lot of baggage that people have around the word manager, but I'm going to go to the more fundamental human dimension. It really is based on how we manage commitments and agreements with people, and we do that even when we don't have a role of manager. But great example of the challenge of people that are given bigger responsibilities, and they actually become the bottleneck for the organization. They actually become the place where their own career path can't advance because they can't make bigger promises. They're still hanging on to being the performer. Thank you, John. Great example. Do we have another one? That was a very, very relevant one, I think.
Bob.
Common. Yes.
Bob, my name is Kyle. My experience was with the big four accounting firms.
Okay.
And what I saw early in my career was that the big four firms were very strong performers, but very limited leadership, even though you have a lot of partners, very limited leadership. And I think your performer to manager theory really typifies what the problem is. In fact, going from senior manager to partner with an extreme role change of going from performer to sales provider, client relationship, and just a host of a variety of skill sets with really no one there to train and kind of focus on development of the partnership group.
Yeah, beautiful. And Kyle, this, in my experience out there in the world today, in the current state, this is a very, very common breakdown. And you've actually identified it not only as a personal breakdown of some individuals, you're saying that an entire organizational culture has this problem, that as they promote people, and the only training these people have had have been to be great performers, and maybe that's even the focus of the offer of the organization, what we're running into is what we're going to call a blind spot, that the organization itself, the individuals that are involved, in fact, our entire culture has a blind spot of what is really involved at these higher levels. And we have successful leaders, and we have mentoring programs where the organizations try to share some of the wisdom of people who have become naturals. But we still have a low success rate. And when we have something that's so important to so many people that has a low success rate, the place that we go from the way that we observe the world is to say that's probably a blind spot. People are doing the best they can. They don't have the right distinctions to even pay attention to the right things. They don't have the framework to learn the right skills. And that's what's missing for many organizations. Thank you, Kyle. Let me lay out some framework here, and we'll come back and do some further discussion. I'm going to share with you what we have learned over the years. And I'm going to do it, though, not from simply having been experienced and come up with some empirical principles, although there's certainly value in that. I want to share with you that there is a foundation of a domain of learning that addresses these issues, and we build our work. I built my career on this framework. It's still not mainstream, but it is effective. So, when I use examples of the shift of cultural blindness, one of the examples that I talk about is medicine. And I think I mentioned in the blog article, there was a time when physicians had a day job, they were barbers, that the discourse of being a physician was so limited and undeveloped that there were very few techniques available, very little understanding. And as the profession developed over time, as new clarity and distinctions were developed, the profession matured. They began to pay attention to things that people were blind to previously. They began to develop new practices that were effective. Amazing as it seems, before Pasteur, who's the historical figure credited with the discovery of germs, before he made that what was called the germ theory accepted in practice, physicians didn't wash their hands before or after surgery and were actually transmitting infection and didn't know it. That's an example of how even in a profession, if we don't have the right distinctions, we may not see the world in the way we need to see it to be able to take the action. So this question of performer to manager brings us to the question, what is a performer? And what is a manager? And what is that path? What is that learning path that has to be followed to go from one domain to another? The simile I use is that if you become a great performer, let's say that's becoming the first violin in a professional orchestra. You are fabulous at what you do. You may even be a virtuoso. You may be an incredible soloist. But being a soloist violinist or the first chair doesn't make you a conductor. And the conductor has a different domain of action. They have to coordinate the action of many other people with many other skills to produce a coherent and valuable whole. And this is very similar to the transition from a great performer to a manager in any field. It goes from being really, really good at what you do. Some of those people that Joan mentioned who don't want to delegate because they're the best person, best performer, to being the coordinator of a group of people, called a team or an organization or a community. So the breakdowns that we encounter when people don't make this transition effectively, and one of the tragedies of not making this transition effectively is not only that people take on management roles that they fail at, but sometimes people take on management roles, they're not good at it, and they continue in the role. The organization doesn't have a standard, a high enough standard to say you're really not an effective manager. So we have a lot of organizational settings where people are ineffective at their role. There's a book published way back when, I think 60s or 70s, called The Peter Principle, that basically said everybody's promoted to your level of incompetence. And this is one reason that organizations seem to have so much challenge, is people are not given a framework for the next level of responsibility so they can be effective at it.
Let's take a look. Something out as well?
Certainly. Who's this?
It's Joan again. And the other thing I'd like to throw out is that not a lot of organizations will allow for a dual track. So there are a few organizations that recognize that there are great individual performers, great salesmen who are not great managers. And maybe they try the management route, hate the administration, and want to go back to doing what they're good at. And not a lot of organizations allow a parallel track. Inevitably, those people who are, with the exception maybe of certain engineers, those people who are individual performers don't quite end up in the top ranks.
Yes. When we face that, this is an example of the blindness of the organization, the blindness of our cultural common sense. And when we give people a management role and they're promoted and they're incented to take on the role because that's the way they can have more success, more income, more impact, it's because they make bigger promises. And when we look at people in performer roles, that track is still available. How do we support people who are great performers to make bigger promises? And when that principle is clear, then this idea of a dual track begins to make sense. Because if we have performers trying to be managers and not being able to fulfill the promise, then we need to have another option for the organization. But I want to take that as a blind spot. Let me highlight here some of what happens when a person goes from one level to another. And in this case, we're talking about performer to manager. But the distinctions I'm going to share with you apply to any transition to a bigger promise. So the first challenge that the person in transition faces is they try to do the next level of their responsibility, the next level of the number of people involved and the scale of the promise being taken care of. They try to do it in the same way they did before because what they did before worked for them. And so they're not even using the right framework, the right distinctions to even think about things. And they often build a situation where they are the key performer and everybody's feeding them, and it's inherently limited. It doesn't grow great teams. I often work with small business owners who face this challenge where they've grown the business, they've done everything in the business, They're better than anyone else in the company at almost everything they do, and they're trying to grow the business. But what they don't see is they built a business that is organized around them. And the inflection point they need to take, my coaching to them, is to say, your job has shifted from being the lead expert to being the builder of the team who fulfills the promises. And when you do that, you become a beginner in a whole new domain. You have to know what a team is. You have to know what growing a team is. And if you want to do that, you'll grow your business. If you don't take on that learning path, then you won't. You will become the bottleneck. And so this characterizes the leadership journey. In this step and subsequent ones, it's always about learning at a new level where your prior understandings are, they're not invalid, but they're inadequate. So when we continue to act as the expert and give orders and directions, the problem that shows up is we usually don't grow a brilliant team. And so we wind up having issues in an organization or a community, and the team isn't able to really function at its best because the leader is becoming the funnel. When that happens, this often happens because people are blind to a different way to do it. And so part of this conversation we're having today is to say there is a different perspective than being the person who knows best or being the expert. Actually, when you get past the first level of promotion, when you're at your second or third level of promotion, you're almost never in charge of promises in which you can be an expert. And this begins to reveal that making bigger and bigger promises is not about being the expert or the top performer. We need to have a different skill set, the coordination of action of other people to make and fulfill promises of value in the world. And when we go past the manager to executive level, everything changes again. The manager's job is to coordinate action to fulfill valuable promises with teams. The leader's job, the executive's job, is to define what promises are worth making and what are the strategies in which a team or an organization can move from where they are into a more valuable promise in the future. Totally different set of conversations and skills. So if we go back to the performer, they often are people who are very comfortable in doing the job, not so comfortable in dealing with other people who don't do it as well. They avoid the breakdowns. They wind up blaming the breakdowns, and they try to keep everything in their frame of knowing. And when the team performance begins to fail, then the manager begins to fail. So if these are the constrictions that produce a failure for this transition, what do people have to do in order to become effective at this transition? So I'm going to name four challenges, four barriers that have to be overcome for ourselves, for the people we lead, people we coach, and in our framework, leaders have to coach, and coaches have to lead. So the first barrier is the one I've already mentioned, blindness. If we don't see that there's a different domain of action and skill, then we won't learn it. We will try to do the best we can. And so we're using the wrong distinctions. We're not paying attention. We can be the physician that's not washing their hands. And with all of our hard work and dedication, we're destroying the very outcomes that we're trying to produce because of our blindness. So what is the blindness that we're talking about in management and leadership? Today, culturally, the mainstream is still not taken seriously what we have discovered in our work. We are still on the margin of a new interpretation that we're trying to bring to the mainstream, which is that the human coordination of action is something that can be seen, understood, and it is also a performance art. We cannot learn to be a great team leader or manager by understanding new concepts or new techniques. It actually requires us to be performers in a new domain, and that domain is the person-to-person interaction that happens in conversation. And so if we've been focused on technical skills or functional skills and haven't really yet developed these skills of person-to-person interaction, then this will limit our effectiveness as a manager. Now, when I'm talking about person-to-person interaction, I'm not talking about being sociable. I'm not talking about getting along with people well. I'm not talking about being a good conversationalist. What I'm talking about is there is an element of conversation in which commitment is made for future action. This is where the coordination of action happens. And so when we work with client organizations and support our leaders and coaches, often people think conversation is simply the chatting. The only real action domain is what we do. But what's missing for most people, it's the establishment of clear agreements that produces the activity, the action, and the results. And so the first thing is we need to dispel the blindness that we don't even know the domain exists. It does exist. It has a structure. It can be learned. And this is what I learned on my path when I first ran into this early in my career. The second barrier is once you see that you're entering a domain of new skills, of new actions, if you're going to become effective in a new domain, you have to become what we call a beginner. You have to become a learner. And this puts people into being out of their comfort zone. They're no longer inside the domain in which they are the expert and know everything. And so this provokes fear. It provokes the fear of I don't know because I should know, but that is already the performer expert's standard. The reason I'm a great performer or expert is because I know. But when you get into leadership, the most powerful skills are dealing with what you don't know. Because as I said, once you get past the first level of promotion, you will be managing promises in areas in which you cannot be an expert. Then there's a whole different skill set. And the first place of working with people that I lead, or with clients, or with leaders that are trying to move themselves forward, and particularly with the performer to manager role, is they have to face their discomfort of being a beginner, of being in a new domain, of not knowing. And we can do that with dignity. It's called being a dignified beginner. And in fact, my experience with the most powerful senior leaders that I've met in my career path is they are always in the spirit of being a beginner. They're not in the spirit of being the expert and knowing. They're always in the question, I don't know everything, and what do you think? And that's what makes them a great leader. So one of the things we need to learn to deal with is the fear that's generated from this I don't know. Learn to be a beginner, and we cannot develop skill in a new domain unless we recognize it, understand there are new distinctions to observe with, and understand that there are different actions and different practices that we need to learn. And that brings us to the third challenge. In our culture, we're not very good at learning because we hold learning as the production of understanding. And in a performance art like management, understanding concepts doesn't make you an effective manager or team leader. It's a performance art. So we need to learn to learn in a new way. We need to learn as dignified beginners. And this actually becomes more important the more senior your position. You need to learn to be a dignified beginner and learn how to make assessments of who you can trust that are experts. That's a key skill when you begin to make bigger promises. You don't need to be the expert, but you need to be able to make assessments of the coherence of the promises of experts. And we need to learn as developing embodied skill in a performance art, not understanding concepts. Unfortunately, most of our mainstream education, MBA programs, for example, still are based on the scholarship model. We study the cases. We study the texts. We may have some great exercises, but we don't do enough follow-through of practice. Now, when you practice management skill and leadership skill, you do it on the job. This is not something you have to do only for homework or go to the gym. You're in conversations all the time. And in fact, this is one of the lovely gifts of this perspective. You can begin learning these skills before holding the position. So if we do that, if we get past our blindness, if we get past our discomfort, if we learn to learn in this new domain of performance, then we begin to see different results. And the results themselves give you feedback. And if you are fortunate enough to have a coach, a mentor, an exemplar who's actually effective, you learn a lot faster. It's a key part of moving forward in your career path and in your contribution. The fourth challenge is that even if people get through the first three barriers, the fourth challenge is they can still be in the framework that I learned some new stuff in a new domain and I'm now an expert again. And this is where we can see people crash and burn at more senior levels. Because in the end, as I said, what we're learning is how to deal with where we don't know. What we're doing is building teams to go beyond what they know, and that's where invention comes from, innovation comes from. That's where we begin to create instead of simply being in the grind of production. And so we need to change our framework of having learned the new stuff so I know to I've learned the new stuff, and that's given me a new set of questions, had me given me better eyes to illuminate even more of what I don't know, and I want to work at the edge. It doesn't mean we invalidate what we know. It doesn't mean we invalidate our skills. It just means we don't limit ourselves to them. And when we do that, the path of learning in human coordination to management and to leadership becomes a path of lifetime learning. So when we can begin to see that path and find the guidance and the help we need to learn it, then we arrive at a place that I would characterize as you're taking your profession seriously. Management is a profession. Now, if you look at how managers are promoted and trained, it's not treated as a profession. I would never go to a physician that was trained the way we train managers. But it is a profession. There is a body of work. There is a body of practice that will enable people to be effective as managers and to grow themselves in that career path. We need to see that we need to get out of some of the performer habits. But instead of being about what I know, it needs to be, and my performance and success, it needs to be about the team's success. One of the key places that changes the game is to see that the reason a team exists is to make and fulfill promises of value and satisfying customers with them. That begins to show a whole different set of conversations and coordinations than simply being the expert getting stuff done. We need to learn that breakdowns are part of the job, not a place to blame. We need to learn that conversations include the dimensions of body, emotion, as well as language, and that makes it a performance art. We need to have a focus on growing the team members rather than simply using them. We need to learn to listen for commitment, to assess promises as to whether they're trustworthy or not. And this is a skill that we can develop in domains in which we're not expert because we can assess the promises, the coherence of the assessments, the evidence that people provide to our experts. And finally, we need to learn to go beyond not knowing to a path of learning as a path of joy. And so if we look at some of the key distinctions, let me mention a few of them that are unavoidable. We can't avoid that management and team or leadership happens in conversation. We can't avoid that it involves listening well and that coordination happens around commitment. We can't avoid that connection and resonance is fundamental to leadership presence and teamwork. We can't avoid the structure of coordination, and we can't avoid that conversations and how well they produce a shared future and coordination includes the dimensions of body, emotion, and language. I call these distinctions non-discretionary. They're not included in most current interpretations of management and leadership. It's why people struggle to develop their skills in them. But these are non-discretionary because they're there. It's just like medicine has learned more and more about the body, and the body doesn't care what your state of medical theory is. It is the way it is. It works the way it works. And human coordination of action, although very open to different style, has a fundamental structure. And we need to learn that if we're going to take it on as a profession. So with all that, then we want to come back to connecting for ourselves let me offer some starting points for taking this perspective into your own work and life. One is to see that the power and meaning of any objective purpose or promise has to do with the internal phenomena of care. Not only your care, but if you're in a team situation, the care of the individuals on the team. What is an organization structured to in terms of what it cares about? Do the people care about that? And how do they take action with it? Is to translate the care into taking care, translate it into commitments. And that takes us to conversations and agreements and coordination. And when we do that, we begin to see that the old myth that management is simply about organizing tasks well and driving people to perform them, that's the old common sense. It doesn't work very well. And this new framework begins to open up to where action comes from our human core. And that's when we begin to see the path that can be meaningful. And finally, one of the breakdowns that we can have in management as we develop our career is actually get good at it and crash and burn because we exhaust ourselves. We don't know how to take care of ourselves. We wind up following the promotion and wind up on a desert island saying, how did I get here? This isn't what I wanted to do with my life. And so this question of what you care about is not simply personal desire. It's also the question at the depths of what are you here to do? What is the meaning for your existence and your contribution? And when we begin to have these elements available to us, we begin to have a space for design. So that's my offer to you today as an overview of how the leadership journey of making bigger promises to take care of what you care about is also a human journey. It's also the manager's journey. And that this transition from performer to manager is a very revealing place of challenge to see what is the path of learning that needs to be taken if we're going to go to being effective with other people in the world. So let me open up here for comments and questions that have been provoked from what I've shared with you. See how it's landed, questions have provoked, or what's missing for you. Who's got a question?
Bob, this is Barbara.
Hi.
Hi. I'm curious if effective is time and place. So sometimes does an effective manager that comes on maybe early in a process look different from the effective manager that might come on, past entrepreneurship, if you will, even in a large organization, or even post being in the, past entrepreneurship in the middle part. So I'm just curious, is effective time and place?
Yeah. Time and place is part of it. Let me offer a perspective here. It's really about what is the promise that has to be fulfilled. And all promises have what I call a life cycle. There's a moment when any promise didn't even exist as a spark of an idea in anybody's head. And then a concern arises. And then conversations begin to happen. And then someone has a vision. And then it begins to be formulated. And then it begins to come together as a possible real reality. That real reality begins to be formed into an offer in the world that has value. Then we really organize to say, are we going to commit to this outcome, this promise, what we call a condition of satisfaction? Do we build a team? Do we invest the money? And I'm almost giving you the story of a startup here as an entrepreneur. But the same thing happens with an idea or a new promise in an organization as well. And because we don't understand the life cycle of the promise, we often get stuck only in the old promises we know. So people are trained to the next phase, which is how do we begin to develop the pragmatics of the promise? How do we develop the processes? How do we make it efficient? How do we make it competitive and valuable? And then we have the operational full execution and delivery, and often that results in a process that has to be continued with some care to be done well and has to be updated as the world around it changes. And it constantly has to be focused on the value to the customer. And so The answer to your question is yes, but I'm giving a different dimension to add to what does the human brain bring to the time and place. And there's a beautiful articulation by Richard Strozzi Heckler that he called the anatomy of energy, in which people have embodied a familiarity and a competence and a joy in different phases of this life cycle of the promise. So some people are simply visionaries. Some people love bringing new ideas into reality, but they don't want to stick around in operations. Some people are really good at operations. And so part of building a team is having all these functions represented in the life cycle of a promise or process. And as a leader, we may be particularly good at one of them, but when we get our promises big enough, our job is not simply to plug ourselves into the phase that we're comfortable in. If we really want to grow ourselves, it's how to see how to bring other people in who are good at these other phases. Am I answering your question?
Oh, absolutely.
And so if we see the life cycle of a promise this way, it begins to clarify the challenges, because we have, you know, the wrong person in charge at the wrong moment, or the wrong team, or one of the breakdowns of entrepreneurs, they like to surround themselves with a bunch of visionary possibility people, and they never produce anything because they don't understand the structure of the promise itself. Okay?
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Good. Who else? Comment or question? What have I provoked here? Maybe I can go back to Kyle, see how this would show up if we applied it to one of the big four.
Hi, this is Kyle.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
So out of this new territory we've kind of mapped out here together, how does this strike you as being a way for the situation that you mentioned in the big four, where people are, you know, performer experts all the way up, how this framework would allow them to produce a more vibrant, more innovative, value-creating culture?
You know, it's very interesting. Back in 2005, 2006, when the economy was moving quite rapidly and great things were happening in the professional services area, there was this sense of optimism and sense of higher learning. And then when reality struck, it seemed to that the mood changed in the environment, and no longer was there this sense of generative, you know, leadership or generative thought that people would continue to grow and expand. It was go back to what you know, go back to performance, and it really seemed to change the way that they looked at progression, you know. And so I think that goes back to that beginner-learner theory of if you're too afraid to try something new, and try to learn something, you're not going to reap the benefits of that. And so I think that that's kind of where they're at right now, is I think many of those firms, and, you know, I've seen Clayton Christensen and others talk about how that structure is headed for a change because of that.
Absolutely. You know, when you look at the history of companies, most companies don't last for more than 25 years. Very, very few do. Very rare. And they get so focused on doing what they do very well and forget to keep this conversational space of how is the world changing, what's going on out there, and how do we navigate into the future. It's a missing conversation. And it needs to be something that's a fundamental skill with a fundamental recurrence, not simply a reaction to the breakdown. And there's a phrase I read once that referred to this capacity to be creating the future as innovation. The phrase was, on the road to success is a road to innovation. And on that road, you're either a driver, a passenger, or roadkill. And the opportunity here is to show people that those three roles of driver, passenger, and roadkill actually are defined by the conversations they have or are not having. And it's something that can be learned if they want to be perhaps industry leader would be the grand, but just simply being someone who's creating the future in an effective way. And from that point of view, from the human point of view, that applies to each of us individually as much as to an organization. Resonate for you, Kyle?
Yes.
Yeah, very good. Well, good. Then I'm going to wrap up here. We're getting to the end of our scheduled time. I want to thank you all for joining the call. I hope this was of value to you. I hope there's something here you can take and go. The next step I would suggest for you to be able to take this new frame is to notice conversations. And whatever the situation you're facing, whatever the breakdown you're facing, whether it's performer to manager or the breakdowns of a team or organization, just really pay attention to the conversations that are happening and not happening. Successful coordination comes from committed agreements that are managed well in terms of going through breakdowns and being updated. And when we have failures and breakdowns, usually that's missing. And so the first place that I invite people to really practice is when you listen to the conversation. See if you can listen to the moments of agreement or disagreement or missing agreement. And if there is an agreement, what does your body tell you about the level of commitment to the agreement? It's amazing how that will clarify what's happening and what is produced. And that's where we need to go as leaders. We need to create this space of honest, powerful agreements with a safe place to deal with differing assessments, breakdowns, because that's where we can learn and improve. And too many organizations don't have those conversations and don't have a safe place for the voices. So thank you for joining our call. If what we're doing here is resonating with you, check out our live programs. That's where we take this body of work and actually begin to practice it, hands-on practicing. We provide all the details. We lay things out for you and give you a chance to practice. Our longer programs, we actually give people personal coaching to have your work of learning be by doing in your practice, in your leadership. And so with that, thank you very much. I look forward to the conversation we'll have next month. And let me turn the call back to Johanna. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Bob. And thank you, everybody, on the call and for your time. And again, we have these calls every month. So if you are interested in joining us again, actually April 15th for our Coaching Excellence in Organizations call, 10 to 11 a.m. Mountain Time, how do we generate leadership and generate leadership in others? And we have our generative leadership call again May 6th from 1 to 2 p.m., Leadership Inside Out, Developing Inner Strength, Peace, and Health. And if you have questions around our longer programs, our opening conference, Foundations for Generative Leadership in September in Boulder and November in Seattle, feel free to email us or call us. Our number is 303-527-9905. 303-527-9905. And my email address is jklouda@generativeleadership.co. You too. Bye-bye.